Welcome to the forum from the BBC World Service, where we enrich your thinking with past insights and future visions. Hello, I'm Bridget Kendall. Revolutions in sex and science this week, and the transforming power of laughter in the ancient world. With three guests, all of colossal stature in their different fields, Austrian-born Professor Carl Gerassi, co-inventor of the contraceptive pill, American Harold Varmus won a Nobel Prize for his work on cancer and is now scientific advisor to President Obama, and Professor Mary Beard, often described as Britain's best-known classicist. It's great to have you all here in the Forum studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Carl Gerassi, can I start with you? You're Emeritus Professor of Chemistry at Stanford University in the USA, also an author and playwright, and it's over 50 years since you were instrumental in developing the pill, the first synthetic oral contraceptive for women, a breakthrough which changed forever the way millions of people behaved and thought about sex, divorcing the act of sex from possible pregnancy. But you're saying that the gap between sex and reproduction is going to widen still further, and that it's not just that you can have sex without it leading to pregnancy, but also the other way around, where you can get pregnant without having sex. Now, this is all about advances in IVF treatment, isn't it? In vitro fertilisation, and specifically intracytoplasmic sperm injection, or ICSI for short, where just one single sperm is needed and injected directly into the egg. So can you tell us more about these new advances that are making such a difference?
That is only one of the in vitro techniques. I think you have to take one bigger jump, and that is really the future. Namely, you can preserve sperm for decades. We already know this. Sperm banks can freeze the sperm. There are enormous advances now in freezing eggs or even ovarian tissue. And within less than 10 years, I'm quite sure that that will have been technically as solved as sperm freezing it now. So you will really be able to preserve your eggs or sperm in the bank, so to speak, and then check them out when you want to have a planned child. And the fundamental thing is the question of planned children as compared to inadvertent children. And there's a very important, very dramatic illustration for this. There are roughly 100 million acts of sexual intercourse in the world every 24 hours, resulting in 1 million births every 24 hours, half of them unexpected and half of those unwanted. That's 250,000 unwanted births every 24 hours, leading to about 50,000 abortions every 24 hours throughout the world.
So what you're saying is that these new advances in science are leading to ever more planned reproduction.
They could. These are options.
And just to make it absolutely clear, the really important thing about ICSI, as you call it, intracytoplasmic sperm injection, is that, amazingly, you only need one sperm to fertilise an egg, unlike the millions of sperm that normally happen when it just happens organically.
Correct.
Harold Varmus, you wanted to come
in. I'd just like to ask Carl to elaborate on the other side of the formula. We all accept the idea that we prefer sex to babies and that many of us have sex in a way that is extremely unlikely to lead to pregnancy. But what I haven't seen is much evidence for the idea that people are going to have their babies when they actually want them by using in vitro fertilization if they're fertile.
No, the answer is of course not. But what they will do is, first of all, plan to have. They're already planning to have one.
Sure.
But then now we have to get to the much more important point, and that is really the change of women, so women's status during the last 50 years in particular. 100 years ago, 5 or 6% of married women in the United States worked. Now it's over 70%. The majority of families in many countries are single mothers. Women postpone childbearing, particularly in certain countries, for various reasons, because women can move into positions that were not open to them. These women postpone childbearing because they can't do both things at the same time, and they say, well, we'll worry until mañana comes. Mañana means 35, and suddenly you discover between 35 and 40, there's a tremendous difference. I think these advances will be able to postpone the biological clock easily by 5 years if you can store your young eggs. and then use them as, in other words, as insurance, and use them when you want to have children. I'm talking about that change of situation.
That overcomes one aspect of, of late pregnancy, namely Down syndrome, but it does, or it helps.
Let's just unpick this for a moment. If you if you harvest your young eggs, then you're much less likely to run into some of the
Down
genetic
syndrome,
problems
for example.
Well, not only the genetic problems. I mean, Down syndrome is only one. Yeah. The fact that infertility decreases enormously by the time you
But there's still the burden of carrying a child at age 40. I think Mary wants to
pitch in. Let's
here.
Bring Mary
She's waving her hands in the air for you radio viewers.
There's a woman's voice here. And of course, I'm absolutely with you about all the problems that there have been traditionally, not only in this country but everywhere, about the relationship of childbearing to women's careers. But when I hear you speak, I kind of feel a nightmare scenario is in prospect. Because I think, okay, let me run my life differently. And I've harvested my eggs at an early age, and I've got my chair, everything's going fine. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to get pregnant, age 45, with these nice young eggs and some nice young sperm, and everything.
And you only need one sperm.
I'd be absolutely super, no problem. Everything would be hunky-dory, except there I'm going to be 45, 50, you know, the kids are going to be 15 and I'm going to be 60. And I kind of replay this and I think, look, what I needed, I didn't need all this technology. What I needed was good childcare when I was 30. If I'd had good, adequate childcare when I was making my career, and if it was fully established that blokes played as full a part in child rearing as girls, then I wouldn't need to go down this route.
I'm 100%. In agreement with you, I wrote a very contentious article on that called My Mom, the Professor for Science, some 24 years ago when I suggested exactly this, make it possible. But that is idealistically speaking. You have to talk about the value judgments of contemporary society in certain disciplines. You're talking about the ideal situation where I completely agree. I'm talking about options. I'm talking about there are certain women who would want to do this, certain men who would want to do this. There are certain advantages also for... There are actually recent studies why younger men's sperm is in fact better than older men's sperm, even though we produce them all the time. But I'm purely talking about options. That's all I'm talking about.
It is really interesting, though, isn't it? Because if everyone's very focused on good health, and certainly on they want the optimum health for any children that they might have, these are arguments, Kyle, you're saying that they will make, that, you know, it makes sense to harvest your eggs and sperms early because you have a better chance for the fetus. I wondered, Harold Varmus, as you're currently advising President
I think we need
Obama
to be careful about that. I chair one of his advisory committees. I'm not the science advisor. That's John Holden, somebody else.
But, okay, but I mean...
But I have a role. But I still have a main job, a day job, as running a cancer center.
That's true. But we've already seen movement with the Obama administration lifting the federal ban on funding of stem cell research. I just wondered, in this whole area of movement, scientific movement forward on reproductive issues, what ethical and social considerations for governments you see here?
But that depends much on the country.
Well, exactly, and what the country and the issue.
I mean, United States is a wild west of reproductive medicine. No regulations whatsoever because of the extreme situations. You had at one time the Bush administration, which was as fundamentalist as you could be. Then you can go to San Francisco, which is as wild west as you can be in that respect. The UK is a very good example. UK is probably the most sophisticated, in my opinion, intelligent legislative process. There are certain European situations that have it. You have Germany, Austria, Italy, that are ultra-conservative, and many things you can do in Belgium and the UK you can't do there.
The U.S. has always been strange in that we tend to govern the use of our money, citizens' money. That tends to be the major thing, whereas in UK, you make decisions through a parliamentary body that affects whether research is done or not, or whether certain modalities of care are available. But in the U.S., we allow anything to happen outside of the government sector. And the bans that have been so fiercely fought over have been bans on use of federal funds for certain kinds of stem cell research, certain kinds of embryo research. We've never spent a single federal dollar on research for in vitro fertilization, even though the process is widely used, and many people who are very conservative in ideology have had children and grandchildren who were
But what ethical problems do you see coming? Because, I mean, we've talked a bit about the issue of women and whether being an older woman is a good thing or a bad thing for a young egg. But there are other issues, aren't there? Because you could use the sperm of someone who's recently died and frozen it, for example. Or if you use this process where you can just use one sperm to fertilise an egg, you can actually choose the sex of the baby and screen it for various genetic problems.
I don't think we want to overemphasize the use of single sperm technology, because while Carl's quite right, this is an interesting technology that does overcome some specific infertility problems. For the vast majority of in vitro fertilization events, you use a mixture.
No, Harold, that is changing. You are absolutely right, historical, but it has changed so dramatically, because if you do go through the freezing scenario, which will come, there are relatively few examples, it is ICSI. It's probably the method you're going to use for fertilizing thawed eggs, mm-hmm. and if you move in that direction.
Yes, otherwise, if you move in that direction, but we really haven't moved that fast in that direction.
I think in 10 years you're going to find that, particularly when you start using storing ovarian tissue rather than eggs, but, you know, these are technical aspects. You're talking about the ethical question, which is really much more important. And I really believe, and this is why I would disagree in part with Mary's otherwise justified comment. These are individual decisions, and the attempts to legislate have never worked, really. They breed medical tourism. They encounter medical evasion. The example is abortion. Abortion totally forbidden in the Catholic Church. The highest incidence of illegal abortion is in all Catholic Latin America. Why? Because there's certain forms of contraception which are not practiced. So the women do make individual decisions.
I'm not sure I understand Mary's position.
Let's just bring Mary in back in here.
Just to clarify what I said before, I do want to.
Because you weren't outlawing things; you were favouring other solutions.
I also think that somehow mucking around with reproductive technologies is actually letting all sorts of other social issues somehow get buried, like women's role in childcare. I mean, all it seems to me that Carl is suggesting for us is that instead of looking after the kids when you're 30, you look after the kids when you're 45.
If you want to, and not necessarily.
And there are probably plenty of people who are 45 who aren't looking after their kids, too.
Yeah. But if you say, look, if you take a broadly, low-key feminist position and say, the reproductive health and practice is absolutely centrally a part of whether it's the glass ceiling, women's problems about breaking through to career success, whatever, a totally well accepted fact. You say, what is going to change this? And what is going to change this is your idealistic revolution in how we think about childcare, whose right and obligation it is to provide it, and what the role of the man is. Because again, this tends to be women's reproductive things that are being taken care of, not blokes.
I disagree. I disagree. You've got the conclusion. You're right about that. The interesting consequence, I believe, is that instead of thinking that you're going to jeopardize or change the nuclear family, which is starting to go to pot very much in Western countries, it's the reverse. A wanted child is a love child, a planned child. And I think the role of a father is going to be a very crucial one. Instead of always emphasizing just the genetic role, it will be a fathering role. And there are countries that are doing something about this. A good example, the two European countries where the population decline is starting, Joe said, is France and Sweden. Both countries, in France in particular, also financial incentives of the type that other countries don't have, as well as improving the childcare. In Sweden, a very good example, where they have this very, not only a rather good childcare facility in comparison to other countries, but the 1 year parental leave, of which a father must take certain months, forcing them really into the role of a parenting father.
Can I just look in a bit more detail at this question of parenting and family? Because if you do have reproduction which is more divorced from the act of sex, some people would say, well, isn't there something rather important that's being lost, which many people would say ought to be the starting point of a family, the expression of physical love between two parents, which then results in a child. Does it matter if we lose that link?
But excuse me, you do maybe have 1,000 acts of sexual intercourse, of which one or one and a half will lead to this 1.5 average children.
The experience of in vitro fertilization is the opposite. The people have been desiring to have children, haven't had them, then solve the problem with in vitro fertilization. Those children are very, very, very much loved.
I think the kind of nostalgic view about
about
sex, love, and
came out of a bed. I think that's doesn't help so much later on. You know, I'm a fan. I think Carl is too, of the idea that we scientists generate technology, and how it's used is really a societal issue, but we really haven't resolved this question of what do you make of people's aversion to the notion that if you can use individual sperm, that you could actually select, we now say male versus female, but young versus old, but it's quite feasible you could actually select sperm in a more sophisticated way, and perhaps eggs as well, and that kind of planning.
No,
I
think you people miss two very important points. The most important point about the use of in vitro fertilization for fertile people is not the issue that we talked about, although they are important, but the enormous advances which occurred at the same time in a very separate field, genomics, and the ability to be able to screen for genetic, not even abnormalities or normalities, very readily, quickly, with one cell. This occurred about the same time. The desire for people to try and have, when they have only one, two children, to have the best child, the most intelligent, the most beautiful, the desire. I'm not saying it's good. I'm telling you the desire, which you already do now. You're doing it by, you want to send your child to the best school. You want to have the best.
This is all about control, isn't it?
Absolutely.
The ability that science
gives you to
have
control. I think it is
control.
Important. You're raising fair points, Carl, because it's also important to point out to the listeners that when genetic testing is used now, it isn't used for traits of that kind. It could be conceivably in the future. Right now, we're talking about excluding the birth of a child with cystic fibrosis. Or
let's bring in Mary Beer.
And then for other genetic, and then you want to eliminate certain diseases altogether at the pre-implantation genetic.
I'm beginning to feel terribly uneasy about this because I think there are bigger and different ethical issues that you're raising. This is all about choice. It's about first world choice. It is about the choice of the privileged. It's about people like me who might decide that this would be a very useful way of giving myself the best chance for Nobel Prize winning son. Wait a minute. How far do you think that the kind of high-level, high-privileged, expensive kind of reproductive technologies that you enjoy, let's say exploring, how far do you think that's ever going to have an impact outside a relatively restricted number of wealthy Westerners?
A very simple way. All you have to first of all do, and again you hit a very important point, the question of expense. This is why I wrote an entire book about it called Sex in an Age of Technological Reproduction. I really believe that one has to think about social equality. If you have the rights to this sort of thing, it cannot be cost-controlled. It has to be covered by some form of insurance. Interesting enough, the UK is the first country that has moved in the direction in that certain in vitro fertilization things for infertile people are covered by your national health insurance. Of course, not at all in our country. The actual cost factor, that would have to be carried by society as a question of equity.
Move outside American Western Europe.
Like Sardinia, where there's a high incidence of thalassemia, then the standard of living is not incredibly high. Everybody has been screened for thalassemia, and the number of live births of children who are going to have thalassemia destined to suffer from this disease is fallen to zero. So I don't agree with you that maybe the most sophisticated techniques will take long to appear in Africa. Yes, but the range of application of these technologies is greater than you think.
Okay, we're going to have to call it to a halt there. You're listening to The Forum from the BBC World Service. Now it's time for our 60-second idea. I don't suppose anybody thinks that the world is a perfect place. So every week I give one of my guests the chance to improve on it and come up with one succinct idea which they think would change things for the better. And today I'm asking classicist Mary Beard to try and win us over. That's Carl Gerassi, Harold Varmus and me, Bridget Kendall. And you've got to convince us, Mary, about the merits of your idea in just 60 seconds. So, if you've gathered your thoughts?
I have.
OK, your minute starts now.
My idea is a truly liberating one. It is to shut down our prisons and let all the inmates free, except for those that present a real and physical danger to other human beings. I'm sure that when future generations come to study the history of the 21st century, they will be completely baffled by our obsession with locking people away. Why on earth, when it costs more than a five-star hotel per night per inmate, and when its only obvious effect was to turn run-of-the-mill wrongdoers into hardened criminals, why on earth did we persist in putting shoplifters, fraudsters and flashers behind bars? Why was our only response to more crime longer and longer sentences? One day, this will seem as cruel, bizarre and counterproductive as deportation for sheep stealing. Why can't we devise some more appropriate and useful punishment? I don't want to let errant bankers off scot-free. I want to see them working their socks off to pay back what they've stolen. Couldn't we get them building a few schools, hospitals, railways?
Mary Beard, thank you very much. So this is all about prisons being expensive, cruel and ineffective, because it just turns out more hardened criminals. But what useful punishments? Building schools is all very well, but is that really going to make a difference to people who have broken the law and done something that's caused problems to other people?
I think what you've got to say is we're not stupid, we're smart. An enormous amount of human intelligence, energy and money goes into propping up a custodial system that is absolutely clearly not working. There's
If you've ever sat on a jury of someone who's dealt with a small amount of cocaine, watching this person about to go back to jail for 10 years at public expense, you realize this is absurd. That first of all, he's only a minor figure in this chain of drug abuse. So sending him to prison is not going to do any good. The whole point should be to try to figure out a way to defer further crime committed by this person by teaching him a trade, finding another way to live. It's not always so easy, but I think...
So your solution is education. What about you,
Carl? Well, it's a combination of tasks and education.
Look, I'll buy the argument, but your problem is the example you then start using, Mary, is the errant banker. And you're talking about the white-collar person. And you better talk not about the errant banker, but you talk not about the murderers, but really some compulsive, really rather violent robber and so on. Who is going to decide which people do deserve to be locked in? I am completely on the side of Harold describing the people there, the petty thieves and things like this here. And for all of them, however, but there's errant banker and so on, and even the worst ones, people, you know, have been chopping stones, the gangs at one time, and others could have social services. And you can think of, particularly in the present economic climate, you can think of all kinds of things that you could have these people do that would be socially productive and much cheaper.
Okay, very briefly, Mary, what's your solution from the classical world? You're a classical scholar. What lesson could they tell us?
Afraid they have a very bad lesson. They send everybody into exile. I'm afraid a policy of exile in this country would not be either successful or plausible.
Right.
There's nowhere left to send people, anyway.
Antarctica.
Well, you've heard what our panel think. We'd also like to hear your thoughts. If you want to hear Mary's idea again, go to the forum webpage at bbcworldservice.com, where you'll also find a link to a podcast of the entire programme. And you can contact us via the forum, that's just one word, at bbc.co.uk, or write to us at BBC World Service, Bush House, London. You're listening to The Forum from the BBC World Service. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. This is The Forum from the BBC World Service. I'm Bridget Kendall. This week our theme is creation and procreation, from the genesis of life itself to the dissemination of new scientific research and what it is that generates laughter, a comparison of ancient and modern humour. Here with me in the studio are British classicist Professor Mary Beard of Cambridge University, the co-inventor of the contraceptive pill, eminent American professor Carl Gerassi, and the Nobel Prize-winning cancer expert Harold Varmus on his campaign trail to open up new scientific research to everyone. Now, I want to turn to you, Mary Beard, Professor of Classics at Newnham College, Cambridge. You've written extensively on ancient Greece and Rome to a very wide audience, and you're currently immersed in a study of what laughter meant in ancient times, what made the Romans laugh, and how far we share their sense of humour. So let's start, Mary. Can you give us an example of a Roman joke?
A Roman joke, yeah, okay. There were three men, a barber, a professor, and a bald man, planning to go on a trip. It's a long journey, and they realised that they would have to camp out overnight. because they got quite valuable luggage with them, they decided that they would have to take it in turns to keep watch over the luggage. They would do a four-hour shift. The barber was the first man to take the shift, and he got very bored. So in order to pass the time, he shaved the head of the professor. And at the end of the 4 hours, he woke him up. The professor stretched, kind of scratched, put his hand to his head and found he hadn't got a hair. "What an idiot that barber is," he said. "He's woken up baldy instead of me."
Well, it raises a smile from
a bit. I'm not a good audience for jokes because I don't remember jokes and I don't really can't tell them. It's okay.
It's okay. Mary, what was particularly Roman about that joke?
Well, there's two things that are particularly Roman. The first is many, many Roman jokes have a focus on issues of identity. Who am I? Now, there's a bit of that in modern humour and laughter with, you know, people dressing up and pretending to be other people. But we don't have this real centred issue of how on earth do I know who I am? You know, we know how we know who we are. For better or worse, we've got passports. We may or may not have ID cards. We've got birth certificates. We know when we're born. We know, you know, bearing in mind all the problems that these guys have raised, we know who our parents are. In antiquity, that was all those things were up for grabs. Mm. You know, who's my mum and dad? Lots of jokes about who dad is because...
You know, we have those jokes, too.
Increasingly,
actually, they
yes.
could be coming back.
Yes.
even with DNA testing.
At least DNA gives
you then sometimes it's another kind of joke.
So who's dad? But also, who am I? It's another very short one, which says a man met a friend of his, and he said to the friend, "Oh, I'd heard you were dead." "No," says the bloke. "You can see, here I am, I'm alive." That's odd, because the guy who told me you were dead is much more reliable than you are.
But it's more than just defining what defines you. It's knowing how you know who you are, which is the subtle part of it.
It's an extremely sophisticated bit of – it's a real glimpse into Roman worries, anxieties, but in a sophisticated way.
Is that different to our current jokes now?
I think that we do not have that – plethora of jokes like that. We have some, but...
Is that because of Freud, who taught us that what we are is in our mind and we don't, you know, it's not some externality that defines
there's
us?
There's two things. One is, you know, the post-Freudian generation looks at identity and looks at the ego in a quite different way. But it's also, I think there's a practical social factor, as I was saying before, that we, in most day-to-day circumstances, perceive our identity as known. We know who we are. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one thing... I thought this was extremely important because you suddenly see one of the biggest differences about living in antiquity is it's a reasonable question to say, who the hell am I?
Yeah. But an interesting question then is that if we can appreciate the wit in these jokes and then therefore they translate across 2,000 years.
That's the second reason why they're so very Roman is the other factor, it seems to me, that I've been working on in Roman jokes is that they still speak to us. We still can find this funny. And the most surprising thing of all in working on what makes ancient people laugh is that across two millennia, you can still see what the joke is. Now, partly, of course, that's because people like me are good at translating it. We translate it to make it funny.
It's also the structure, because it's three guys walk into a bar. Yes. It's three people go on a trip.
That's right.
You're creating a social situation, a drama, and
course,
a very, very quick
one. That's right. And I have cheated because that's the only Roman joke I've come across, which is
there
were three men. Right? And so, of course, it's the one I tell.
It translates easier.
And so one's massaging it into something that we can understand. But nevertheless, I think that an extremely interesting Roman joke book of the 3rd or 4th century AD, 250-odd jokes, and its hit rate of making you laugh is awful lot better than most joke books you could buy in station bookstores.
Making you laugh?
I think that I have a fairly Catholic taste.
I mean, I just wonder if a classicist has a sort of broader view of Roman jokes than a normal person who you might tell them down the pub, because you're talking across the millennia, but to...
That's
possibly a more educated audience.
That's true, but there's a stand-up comedian, Jim Bowen, who came across this Roman joke book quite recently and did a whole stand-up show out of the jokes in the Roman joke book, apparently.
Did he have to explain where they came from?
He did explain where they came from, and I think in some ways that is quite an interesting framing of this, because I've heard recordings of the audience listening to Jim Bowen really laughing, and you say, what are they laughing at, actually? And partly they're laughing at the jokes, partly they're laughing at the way Jim Bowen decides to tell the jokes, but partly they're laughing at the sheer improbability of sitting there listening to jokes that are 2,000 years old.
Well, also appreciating the historical distance and the humaneness of humorous.
The two of you are surprised about this by assuming that a Roman joke automatically should be incomprehensible. The fact that it has to be translated means nothing, because you have to translate a French joke, an Albanian joke, an English joke to other people. So the language makes no difference. The content, I mean, is not any different in terms of appreciating. We still read ancient literature, we read Shakespeare, we read anything. In other words, cultural things can be...
But humour can be different, can't it? I was going to ask you, Carl, as someone who was brought up in Austria, when you went to the United States...
A teenager when I came to the United States.
Okay, a teenager is an important time, though. Did you find that the sense of humour was different? It's about whether humour crosses boundaries.
Well, I don't know. I think sense of humour is really an individual sort of thing. I really haven't questioned it. What is more interesting is the subject of jokes. For instance, ethnic jokes is very common. And we have really almost a counterpart of this. Some of these that you quoted, but, you know, certain cities being considered, stupid people or people on whom you make jokes. Yeah. Every country has such a place, even today, in this place here. We have even in the language, we even just say, I don't know, does he play in Peoria or something like this? But the one thing that I question, which interests me more, and I'd like to ask Harold about this, I have the feeling, although I'm not a joke teller, and I don't remember many jokes, that somehow I don't think that scientists are very much a subject of jokes compared to many other, both professions, occupations, anything like
that's
this.
Interesting.
I don't remember them, and I don't remember that scientists themselves very much tell jokes to other people. Hey, that reminds me of this and that.
Well, I know a lot of scientists who tell jokes and are very, very good raconteurs, but I think people assume that scientists are too serious to be funny. So they don't turn up in these three guys watching.
That's an interesting point, isn't it? Because
except for the idiot savant,
right.
Yes, and there's lots and lots of ancient jokes about the
eggheads.
Eggheads.
Of course, the definition of a scientist was different in Roman and Greek times.
But I'd like to take Carl up on one thing he said, and this idea of the sense of humour being individual. Because it seems to me that anybody who's looked at kids with their parents in the street can see instantly that people learn how to laugh. Mm. Yeah, that laughter may have all kinds of natural roots, but you repeatedly see mothers saying to toddlers who are about to laugh at the man with one leg, don't laugh at the man with one leg. Mm. And then they sit them down in front of The Simpsons or some other funny television programme and they encourage and they show them how to laugh. So laughter, it seems to me, is much, much more, a much more learned experience.
But I'm not talking about that. You asked me about sense of humour. And I'm not talking about content of humour, content of jokes, but either you are, as a character, a person who has a certain sense of humour, you don't really...
Laughter is much more complex than that, because it ranges from what you do when you're tickled to a cruel laughter to the laughter... I'm interested in Carl saying that he doesn't have much of that kind of sense of humour, because
I can't tell jokes.
Yeah, yeah. I have trouble with the same thing, too. My wife complains about this, but you're probably quite witty in repartee, so...
On there, a point that Carl raised about scientists not particularly today being the butt of jokes, I wanted to bounce back on you, Mary, because one possibility of that is because science is a very elevated position in the modern Western world, and there's a certain concern about people, they don't always know enough about it, so it's a bit difficult to make jokes about it. And I wondered, in Roman society, whether that fitted a sense that there are certain areas which you don't joke about because they're too high status or they're too difficult to get at, or whether you can draw a parallel, whether there's anything in that.
The Romans are quite interested in what you should and shouldn't joke about. But most of their taboo topics are much more like my one-legged man example. You don't... it's fine, they say, to joke about the deaf, but not fine to joke about the blind. It's fine to joke about the bald, but not about the smelly. And so they have a range of taboo, non-taboo topics. Now, of course, we know as soon as somebody says, don't joke about the smelly, that's precisely what, you know, under the undercover jokes will be about. But they actually use jokes, as often we have seen across the world, particularly in dictatorial states, that humour, joking and laughter is used both for and against the most important, powerful individuals.
But I'm not sure that in classical times people viewed scientists as a threat. They were, they might be a threat to the perceived worldview, but that's very different from the classical.
They joke about philosophers. The boundary between philosophy and science is, of course, much less pronounced.
Right, the idea of controlling natural forces with
Socrates, they joke about Socrates wanting to look at the heavens. So where does Socrates go to look at the heavens? Well, he goes up a tree, silly idiot, because then he's nearer. In that case, Socrates is performing the role of scientist.
Right.
It's interesting what you're talking about, political jokes on Socrates and so on. This is certainly something which goes across boundaries, isn't it? That jokes are used when you're not empowered to give yourself some kind of control over a situation that you can't.
And they're also used, interestingly, by the powerful, because it's a terribly important part of your political image, whether you're dictator, monarch, or town councillor, to say, I can take that joke. That, in a sense, the dictator survives in part by saying, joke about me, that's fine, because I'm the kind of guy who'll laugh along with you.
Thank you all very much, Mary Beard, for your illumination of the world of laughter in Roman times. You are listening to The Forum from the BBC World Service. Now, Harold Varmus, time to turn to you. You've shared a Nobel Prize for your groundbreaking work in demonstrating that cancer genes can evolve from normal cellular genes. You've directed the world's largest biomedical research body, the American National Institutes of Health. Now you're helping advise President Obama on science and technology and president of a major cancer centre. But in fact, you've come to talk to the forum about a revolution you're driving to do something else, to democratise science by changing the way scientific ideas are shared. So latest scientific findings are accessible to everybody, scientists and non-scientists, and not just those who can afford to pay for expensive top scientific journals. So before you explain what's happening, explain what was the traditional way that a scientist let everybody know that he or she had an important breakthrough?
Well, scientists do that in a couple of ways. One, of course, is just by talking either among themselves or at meetings, but the official way, the way that really counts, the way that improves your reputation in the scientific field is by publishing in what's called a peer-reviewed journal. You submit your manuscript, some of your colleagues at other institutions review the paper, decide if it's technically competent and interesting.
Unknown to you, the people in general?
They probably are known to me, but I don't know who they
That's
are
what
in that
I
case.
Mean.
Right, so they're not known in that case, but they're probably people I know quite well. That may call it a review, if that's what you're suggesting. It's possible. But to come to the real fact, once your paper has been accepted, the journal publishes it, not only publishes it, but takes ownership and assumes the copyright and publishes it for a price, and both expedites the publishing by putting it on pretty paper and in a nice form, but also charges one's colleagues and one's and people one doesn't know to have access to it, and that lasts in perpetuity, well, as long as the copyright obtains.
And your idea is to take the ownership back.
Well, it's all been changed
journals.
By the internet. So everything's driven by technology. We didn't have books until we had Gutenberg. We didn't have journals until they were invented by the Royal Society, where I'm staying tonight,
here in London.
But the internet changes things in a fundamental way. And I'm not an internet guru by any means. I had to have this explained to me by people in physics who actually were making the big breakthroughs by putting all of their papers, even before review, up onto the internet for colleagues to see. And what's now possible is, first of all, to put things into the public domain over the Internet after the subscriptions have been paid and journal publishers have made their money, or even more dramatically, immediately on publication. There are costs. Those costs can be covered by the science agencies that paid for the research as part of doing research. And then once the publication costs, which are pretty trivial, are actually taken care of, then everybody can see it. And it's not just seeing it. You can find it because we have such powerful search engines. And we can amalgamate information and change the way we do science through this new means of publishing, which we call open access publishing.
And you're no bystander to this debate, are you? Because you're chair of
the
public
scars to prove that I'm not a bystander
of science. So yes. You're actively promoting it.
Well, I started pushing this when I was the director of NIH. And since then, I've been chairman of the board and co-founder of something called the Public Library of Science, perhaps the most prestigious open access publishing house. We publish a large number of journals, thousands of articles a year. These articles are immediately in a public digital library for anyone to see, whether you're in Afghanistan or in South Africa, and whether you're doing classics or anything else. And the journal is extremely high quality, and we're changing the way publishing is done.
My other two guests want to come in, but one quick question.
Let's hear from the
your audience. Work, when you were demonstrating that cancer genes can evolve from normal cellular genes, that got you Nobel Prize. How would that have been changed if you'd had open access?
Well, for one thing, everybody would have seen it. In fact, even today, if Carl wants to read that paper from 1976, he can't get it because it's not on the Internet. Nature magazine has never placed it in an open digital library. The only way I was able to see it when I needed a copy for a class I was teaching was by going to Google Scholar and finding that some Midwestern professor had assigned it for class, and Google Scholar had picked it up. So there's a tremendous virtue in having the work accessible.
I think there's a really big issue here about the role of the Internet in knowledge and knowledge dissemination, because in arts and humanities fields, and it's slightly different because we don't honestly, I have to say, have breakthroughs in quite the same way. On the surface, superficially, the Internet has hugely democratized the spread of information, that journals, periodicals, books are online and accessible. What you discover if you look under the surface is that the same hierarchy of privilege has been repeated, that the cost to any institution or any country or any library of subscribing to the online version of the Journal of Roman Studies, let's say, is possibly even greater than subscribing to the print version. And so the medium, which somehow looked as if it was going to really make things open, has reinstated.
No. I've got to make something very clear. I'm not talking about online publishing, subscription-based. Okay, I just want to make it clear to listeners out there that going online, which all of our journals do.
No.
Oh, you can ream the library budget very quickly that way. But
the point I'm trying to make is, you look at the Internet to start with. And you think, this is actually making stuff available. Now, unless you do something like you're doing, unless you say, we are going to have it open access, all the Internet has done has reinforced the barriers between those who get to see this stuff and those who don't.
Let me critique it a little bit. You know, I come from a peculiar position. For 50 years, I was a scientist. I have, published, I hate to say it, over 1,000 papers and completely take this populist view of health. I sympathized entirely with it. I would be on the side in principle. But I'm now a playwright, a novelist, and I'm someone writing about these people and looking more distantly at this here. And also one who's really been working in the third world, in Africa and Latin America and so on. That plays an important function. He makes that point insofar as access to journals are concerned. I would have never had a problem looking at his 1976 paper in Nature at Stanford. I go to the library. I don't care whether I get it or not. What about the poor scientists in Ouagadougou or in Paraguay?
You're very much behind this.
Up in principle. What about the people, the hundreds of thousands of scientists who do not work in the biomedical field and taking chemistry? Now, in that case, the National Science Foundation doesn't have many, many billions, but it's also billions. They do not pay for these scientific papers. Just to give an example, I look.
So, if I understand right, the point you're making is.
So, who's going to pay the bill?
If you have a graduate student who's not got backing from somewhere, from a
graduate student,
from a developing world,
if you don't have money, you don't do research. You've got to have some.
That is not true. That is
very difficult.
That is not completely true. We are talking about money and money. Well, you're absolutely nothing you don't. But I can tell you, when you get research support in countries in the third world, and the third world, kind of many Latin American countries, where every dollar counts, and say these are additional $1,000 per
patient. This is a very important issue, and we are very we're concerned about this, but there are at least two kinds of answers. The first answer was not one that's going to satisfy you, Carl, particularly, but it's true that we take all articles. We've never turned out an article because someone can't pay. So we will just publish it or publish it for much lower amount if someone has a valid reason for not being able to afford the cost. The second thing, perhaps the more important thing, is that the notion of open access publishing has really caught on now. We started making expensive journals to compete with journals like Cell and Nature and Science, and we had to spend a lot of money. Now there are a lot of open access publishers who are basically doing it for free.
I buy that argument.
They're doing it for free.
I know that. I have no problem with it. But now I want to.
Now there's no financial barrier.
Sure, let's go to the next step because I interrupted before.
Right.
The next step is that sort of publishing will undoubtedly produce more papers, which is probably in the whole good, whether they're important mm-hmm. papers are making a difference. You're even willing to consider, as part of it, non-referee journals. You can put anything on there and then afterwards.
As long as it's clearly labeled as such.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But the more important point is the whole notion of post-publication evaluation. And one of the things the Internet makes possible is putting a piece of work up and allowing people to comment on it.
Okay, let me just come in on that then, because if the Internet means that you then have a continual process where you can discuss on the
like
Internet
a
before
journals
you publish,
become like meetings.
And then you publish and then you carry on afterwards and people contribute, you lose this event of publishing. And so who then has intellectual copyright
well,
over the idea?
Well, the paper still is there as a form and a PDF, but the commentary linked to it becomes a very important dialogue that will be somewhere between the face-to-face meeting and our current rather sterile interactions with journals where someone sits in this
study
and reads.
Yeah, this is, and then it's completely different from a poem or downloading music.
I charge for my book.
I totally accept Carl's problems, but I think they're problems that are steps in the way, because if you say the important thing about this is that everybody, no matter whether they're in a rich country or a poor country or a rich institution or a poor institution, should have access to this knowledge, it's the only way that you can go.
But we're talking the reverse. I'm talking not access to the knowledge, that is true. I'm talking about the ability to publish yourself, because according to this, right now you have to pay for that.
You don't need it. If you can't afford it, we will publish it.
Yes.
Number two, and there are lots of open access journals, but you don't have to pay anything. You just give
are we coming back to the dilemma of
really
control
cheap?
And authority here? Because you want to open it up so that nobody is excluded from seeing this stuff and everybody has the opportunity to publish. But don't you need a sense of authority, a kind of hierarchy, to say, this goes above a certain bar and this is below.
But that gets built into the post-publication critique. And one of the things we're envisioning is a publication process which initially resembled journals but evolves into a way of doing business.
And the Internet has changed the nature of peer review in every sort of sense. You know, so that we all know that when we go to a Wikipedia article, we have to have our eyes open to think, is this a good Wikipedia article or is it a lousy Wikipedia article?
Yeah.
And we're in the process of developing new ways of thinking, what do I believe?
And scholars are not going to go the wiki route and allow anybody else to go in there and change it. But you can comment and correct. And I think, you know, what I'm envisioning is being able to get up in the morning as a scientist in my own field, go to my cancer gene webpage and see what people have said yesterday.
That seemed to be a nightmare.
No, it's good. It's going to be good, believe me.
Okay, a final thought from you, Harold Thomas. Do you think, I've always thought that scientists in some ways are quite individualistic because you have to be focused on trying to move forward to find out new things. Do you think this model is going to mean a more collaborative way of working, which will change the whole thing? In a sense,
open access publishing takes as a model one of the most collaborative efforts in the history of science, namely the Genome Project. The Genome Project put all of its information out there in the web, in fact, within 72 hours. So that was a grand communal effort, which has yielded a lot of opportunity for individuals to go and study individual genes and learn great things and become individually famous. But I think this idea that all scientists are highly individualistic and only behave in a totally selfish manner is a misconception.
Okay, thank you to all three of you. It seems to me this week we've been talking in all different ways about control, the controlling parameters of life creation, the power to control ideas, that's what we're talking about just now, And also the controlling nature of humour, both in Roman times and today. Thanks to all three of you, Carl Gerassi, Mary Beard, Harold Vomas. Don't forget, you can hear the programme again by going to our website, bbcworldservice.com/forum. There you'll find links to our podcasts and the address to send emails to us. Next week, we run the gauntlet of human impulses, from kindness and spirituality to cruelty. Australian philosopher and bioethics professor Peter Singer has a radical recipe to tackle hunger. Iraqi politician and academic Ali Alawi explores how Islam should respond to modernity. And British neuroscientist Kathleen Taylor traces the triggers in our brains that make us all nasty. So be sure to join us. And until then, from me, Bridget Kendall, and all of us here, have a good week.